Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Misfit Faith podcast. I am your host, Jason Stellman. This is episode number 25. Our phone number here is 949-354-2483. And as I mentioned last week or the week before, it's a hard one to remember, but here's how you remember it. It spells a phrase. The phrase it spells is Why Eli Bites. W-H-Y E-L-I-B-I-T-E. I don't know what that's supposed to mean, but if it helps you remember, then there you go. Give me a call if you've got something you'd like me to address on the show, if you've got a question about something that I have said in the past. Call, leave me a voicemail. Don't worry, I won't pick up. Go straight to voicemail, and I will play it on the show. Quick announcement, if you go to jasonstellman.com/shop, the shopping portion of the website where my Misfit Faith audiobook lives. Sometime in the coming week, I am going to take the 7-week series that we just did in the Misfit Faith community, going through my book, Misfit Faith, that came out last year. I'm going to make that series available as a kind of a la carte purchase. And so the audio from those live video chats will be for sale there. I'm going to do it sometime this week. And so I'll announce it on Facebook and social media when it's there. But just something to be thinking about. If you're not a member of the community, perhaps you're not interested in participating live in these video chats that we do, well, the audio from them will be made available to you to access that way if you are interested. And lastly, patreon.com/Jason Stellman is the best way to support this show and the work that goes into it. It's been a little while since I've had a new patron, and so it'd be real great to get a little bit of love over there at patreon.com/Jason Stellman. So if you are a fan of the show and if you like the work that I do, then I would really appreciate if you would consider becoming a patron. And you'll notice that there are lots of different tiers and different rewards associated with those tiers, and it's some good stuff that you get. And so get on it. All right, let's move on. All right, as you know, we've been doing a series here on the show called Faith Getting Woke, and it's been about sort of looking at different areas where the Christian church in this country needs to rethink its position, alter its stance or its posture on various issues. You know, we've talked about the body and the physical world, we've talked about evil, we've talked about power, we talked about LGBTQ issues. Now, my former view, when I was a Presbyterian pastor and before that, when I was a seminary student, my former view would have been something like this: who cares? You know, who cares if the culture doesn't get what the church is doing, if the church is out of step with the culture, so what? You know, Christianity is supposed to be countercultural, and if people aren't into it, well, then too bad, right? Why would we alter our message to suit the tastes or the trends of the day? Right? Well, of course, now, while I would say certainly there is some truth to the idea that Christianity is countercultural and does have a disruptive, subversive effect on the way the world thinks, but nevertheless, we shouldn't fear the world, right? This is the thing that we talked about with Seth way back when we started this series about the body and about the physical world and the material world around us. We shouldn't fear it. And continually incarnating the message is a good thing, right? If God taught us anything in that whole Jesus story, it's that he is in the business of meeting people where we are. And that's something that if the church wants to survive and have something interesting and relevant to say to the world around us, well, then there are certain things the church is going to need to rethink. And the one that I want to talk about in this episode is the issue of escapism. The issue of escapism. You know, there is this sense you get, especially in the evangelical church, where the point of the faith is to kind of just get us out of here and up to heaven, right? I remember someone saying when I was in high school, when I went to Calvary Chapel High School, the youth pastor said, you know what Bible stands for? It means basic instruction before leaving earth, right? There's this very clear sense in which the attitude is that it's just all going to burn. It's all going to burn, so it doesn't really matter. You know, in 2 Peter 3, verses 10 to 13, it says this, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." Right? And so these verses and others like them are often adduced to bolster this idea that the whole point of the Christian faith is to, get us ready for liftoff, you know, get us ready for heaven, for the age to come, for the new heavens and new earth, whatever you want to call it. And the results of this, I would argue, overemphasis on these kinds of passages are pretty drastic. You know, for one example, there's a lack of concern on the part of many evangelical people for social justice, right? Social justice is kind of a dismissed idea, and social justice warriors are this, you know, pejorative, that's a pejorative label you put on people who are kind of liberal, right? And so the evangelical will say things like, well, Jesus says the poor we will have with us always. And so what good is, you know, a handout that will only help their bodies? What they need is a gospel that will save their souls, right? And so there are even Christians who don't tip at restaurants because, you know, hey, what good ultimately is 20 bucks going to do you, right? But instead, I'm going to leave you this tract that tells you about how great Jesus is, right? I mean, talk about the most counterproductive method of evangelism like ever, right? There's also resulting from this escapism a lack of care about the environment, about the physical world that we live in. You know, we hear things like, well, this world is not my home. I'm just passing through, right? This sojourn on earth is a mere layover. You know, it's not my final destination. It's somewhere where I shouldn't get too comfortable. And, you know, people say things like, well, when you're on a trip and you have a layover in Dallas on your way from L.A. to New York, you don't sort of get all settled in at the airport at Dallas-Fort Worth. You recognize it as a mere temporary stop along the way. Well, that's what this earthly life is. And so, therefore, who cares that much about whether we're polluting rivers, whether carbon emissions are depleting our ozone layer? Who cares about things like that? Because after all, what we are really in this for is heaven, that heavenly country whose builder and maker is God. Now, when I wrote my second book, The Destiny of the Species, which is still available on Amazon, I believe, I was sort of arguing this very point. You know, I was sort of arguing that man is hardwired for eternity, that we are not built for this earthly realm, which is bound by time. And I was largely piggybacking on the thoughts of someone like C.S. Lewis or Peter Kraft. But this is how I framed. I want to read just a little portion from that book that kind of gives you some insight into my thinking at the time. I said, what are we to make of this claim that being too heavenly minded means it will be of no earthly good? If we spend too much time thinking about harps and halos, will we lose all interest in earthly happiness and humanitarianism? Let's answer the question with a question. Who is more likely to quit smoking during pregnancy, the mother who plans for an abortion or the one who plans to give birth? The answer should be obvious. Roads that actually lead somewhere are usually better maintained than dead-end ones. And likewise, when our earthly sojourn is seen as just that, a sojourn on the way to our heavenly home, then it is reasonable to assume that this pilgrimage will be taken with great seriousness and care. If death, as all the world's major religions teach, is not the end of the road, but actually ushers us into the presence of the God who gave us life and demands an account of how we lived it, then is it not to be expected that the pilgrim with an eye on his destination will live more purposefully than will the tourist, the goal of whose trip is to get as much bang as possible for his buck? So it is possible to entertain a hope for a future age to come without being irresponsible with this one. So I'm not saying that everyone who believes that there will be some future eschatological age to come is necessarily irresponsible with the way they live in this present world. I'm saying it's just very, very common. It's very, very prevalent. But if you're listening and you do believe that you'll be in heaven one day, I'm not meaning to say that you're, you know, by necessity irresponsible in the here and now. But it is something worth challenging ourselves about. Well, is there an alternative approach? Oh, of course there is. There always is. What if, you know, from the standpoint of the New Testament writers, a future age of peace and justice was indeed the proper expectation? And what if in some sense it still is, but it's not to be by means of some cataclysmic apocalypse, right? And so what if it is the case that the writers of the New Testament indeed entertain this hope for some sort of future age to come, right? Which it kind of seems like they did, right? What if it's still valid to think this, but what if this future age, this new age, whatever you want to call it, is not going to be the result of this apocalyptic breakthrough? But instead, what if the new humanity that Jesus inaugurated, you know, of which he is the prototype, of which he is the model in whom humanity and divinity co-subsist as one, what if this new way of being human and this new way of doing earth is slowly catching on and is little by little eclipsing the former ways of our fathers? And so what if, I'm saying, Jesus, as the kind of new man, as the forerunner or prototype of a new kind of humanity, right? You can read Paul everywhere, and Hebrews as well, to see this. But what if this new way of doing spirituality, humanity, this new way of living on the earth is something that catches on slowly? It's something that dawns, that slowly eclipses the old ways of doing things. What if the new wine slowly bursts the old wineskins? What if it's not about waiting around, you know, and twiddling our thumbs, you know, pulling our collective pud, gazing up to heaven, wondering when magic sky god will show up to fix all the things we've ruined? But instead, what if it's about a new way of being in the world? A depth dimension in which we live from an inner place of spirit, the fruit of which is love. Now, I'm not talking about some wistful and wishful we're the world type of thing, you know, where we kind of reenact Hands Across America while singing Kumbaya. You know, this place of spirit that I'm talking about is not transcendent or otherworldly. It's not something we can do while swaying back and forth with our eyes closed. But this depth dimension, this living out of a place of spirit, involves a deep awareness of and attention to the here and the now, with our eyes wide open. It involves suffering, and it involves sacrifice. It's not something that is a sort of naive set of expectations according to which we're all just going to get along and where it's all rainbows and unicorns. But this new way that I'm describing would involve suffering. It would involve sacrifice. It would involve a willingness to model this new way by bearing crosses and sometimes even getting nailed to them. It's not about getting to God up in heaven. It's about living as though he abandoned that abode altogether and has poured himself out as an offering upon the face of the world. Now, as you may know, the last live talk I gave in the Misfit Faith community which was yesterday, which was Saturday. It wasn't hosted there. I decided to host it on my public Jason J. Stelman author page so that anybody could access it. And so if you go to Facebook and you look up Jason J. Stelman, you'll find my public author page and you'll find the hour-long live chat there for anyone to view for free. And the reason I wanted to do that was to kind of, you know, give a little sneak peek into what we do in the Misfit Faith community, give a kind of promotional bit of access so that people can get a feel for what we do there. Not only do I do a longer hour-long or so live chat as we go through a book together in the Misfit Faith community every Saturday, we just finished my book. We're going to begin next week going through Brian McLaren's most recent book, The Great Spiritual Migration, which is excellent, and I would recommend it to all of you, especially if you're a member of the community. You're going to want to order your own copy so you can follow along. But I also show up kind of at random during the week and answer questions that people have by means of a live video chat. And also, as you know, I'm working on a devotional book called Our Daily Dread. And for all $1 patrons, you get to read the entries as I finish them. And so I'll literally write an entry, and then I'll put it up on Patreon for all $1 patrons to read. And you can interact with it. You can critique it. You can give me feedback on it if you want to. And all $5 patrons actually get access to the live video presentations of those new entries from Our Daily Dread that I give in the Misfit Faith community. Well, what I thought I'd do here in lieu of an interview is provide the audio from one of the live videos that I gave in the Misfit Faith community, in which I present an entry from the forthcoming devotional, Our Daily Dread, and I talk about it, and I, if there are questions, I answer them. This is the kind of thing that I do every few days in the Misfit Faith group on Facebook. So I want you to listen to this. It's about, I don't know, 12, 13 minutes long. If it sounds like something you're interested in, well, you can either become a patron for $1 and access this material in print form. You can become a patron for $5. And you can have access to the videos after the fact. But if you want to engage with this material live, if you want to have access to the Misfit Faith community and all the things that go on in there, as well as meet all the cool people that are a part of that community, people who are on similar spiritual journeys as you are, well, that's for patrons of $25 or more. And so patreon.com/Jason Stelman, you can find out more about those various tiers. But without further ado, here's me from the Misfit Faith community on Facebook presenting an entry from Our Daily Dread. Hey, what's up, everybody? Just thought I would pop in and do another entry from my forthcoming devotional, Our Daily Dread, which, as you know, is sort of a satire or a disruptive take on traditional Christian devotionals. These are short entries based on passages of scripture in which I take a sort of subversive, offbeat look at these passages of scripture. And they're all rather short. If you're not able, obviously, to join us live today, this will be archived in the group for you to watch when you can and comment as you desire. Also, I was toying with the idea of, you know, how many of these should I do? How many of these chapters or little entries should I do before I actually publish the book? Because I'm going to publish it on Kindle and perhaps in hard copy as well. And since it's a disruptive daily devotional, I thought it'd be funny to instead of you expect like 30 or 31 readings, you know, for a month, I thought it'd be funny to do like 37, because why? It's random. It's a prime number. So I may do that. We'll see. This is based upon John 4:21-24, which is the famous account of Jesus and the woman at the well. And the title of it is When Man Outgrows God. The passage says, Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth,
for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. John 4:21-24. This exchange was precipitated by a Samaritan woman's question to Jesus about where the proper place to worship God was located. In her mind, God actually cared about that sort of thing, and she wasn't wrong. Scripture records a time during which God had laid out specific instructions about how worship and sacrifices were to be offered, about who was allowed to offer them, and about where those offerings were to be made. Jesus' response indicates that those days are over. Quote, the hour is coming and is now here, that spirituality will be more, well, spiritual. God is spirit, after all. Now, what if Jesus' words were taken to mean that in the same way that religious consciousness has evolved to the point where we no longer see the need for geographically specific temples with animal sacrifices and bloody altars of stone, likewise, religious consciousness should now evolve to the point where we no longer see the need for the God who supposedly demanded these things in the first place? If God is spirit, and more specifically, if God is the spirit of love, joy, and mercy for the undeserving, Galatians 5:22-23, 1 John 4:8, then perhaps true religious worship is simply walking in the spirit by exhibiting the love and Christ-likeness that dignifies the destitute and downtrodden. Because by going out of his way to speak with a Samaritan woman of questionable character, isn't that exactly what Jesus did? Cathedrals and incense are fine, as are priests and altars. But the moment we elevate religious furniture and finery above the spirit of love they are intended to convey, we may as well secure some temple shekels and purchase a lamb for slaughter, joining the ranks of the backward and unevolved. Hi, Timmy. Timmy's watching. Good to have you with us. If you have any questions, be sure to write them in, and I'll do my best to answer them. The idea, though, behind this exchange that I think is so interesting is, you know, we have no problem recognizing the sort of eschatological movement of God's redemptive plan from the old covenant into the new, right? And that's what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about worship in spirit and in truth, meaning, you know, worshiping with your heart as well as your head. You know, often people sort of take that existential approach to this passage. But I would argue, and I think Jesus makes it clear, that he's not talking so much about an existential shift from external actions to inward feelings in his exchange with this woman. But instead, what he's doing is he is hearkening the movement, the forward linear movement of God's plan from an earlier hour to the hour that now is here, because Christ is here, right? And so the hour before called for geographically specific temples and sacrifices that were offered in a very, very specific way by very, very specific and carefully chosen people, right? But Jesus says the hour is now here when that is no longer the case. Her initial question, once she realized that he was more than just some random guy, her initial question to him was, which mountain are we to offer sacrifices on? This mountain here in Samaria, Mount Gerizim, or the mountain, the Temple Mountain in Jerusalem? Which one? And Jesus does answer. He says, well, to answer your immediate question, not this one, that one in Jerusalem, because salvation's of the Jews. But he immediately begins to question, pick apart, deconstruct, and eventually dismiss the spirit behind her question by saying, but the hour is coming and is now here, because the king is here, where true worship will not be offered on this or that mountain, in this or that temple, by offering this or that animal, but true worship will be offered in spirit and in truth. It's interesting that we have no problem recognizing the movement from old covenant to new that we see reflected in Jesus' response to the woman. But often we behave as though once the events recorded in the New Testament have occurred, then everything just stops. And there is no more movement. There is no more evolution of religious consciousness or of worship or anything else. And we treat the New Testament and its record of God's dealings with people as though it's this sort of frozen in time snapshot of how things will forever be, instead of allowing for what I would consider to be a more risky and dangerous and disruptive reading of the Bible, which would allow for the movement of God's people, the evolution of our religious consciousness, to continue beyond that moment at which the historical record ends in the New Testament canon. So that's kind of what I hint at here, and I'm going to read the passage again because I think it bears some meditation and hopefully some discussion here in the group. I say, what if Jesus' words were taken to mean that in the same way that religious consciousness has evolved to the point where we no longer see the need for geographically specific temples with animal sacrifices and bloody altars of stone, likewise, religious consciousness should now evolve to the point where we no longer see the need for the God who supposedly demanded such things in the first place? I think that's something worth discussing. And, you know, the basic idea behind it is that in the same way that Israel was convinced under the law, especially under the Deuteronomic covenant, that God demanded these sacrifices, you find later, even in the Old Testament, in the record of the prophets later on in the Old Testament, where they are recording God as telling Israel, I never wanted those sacrifices in the first place. You wanted to give them, and so I let you, because that was kind of the, you know, warp and woof of ancient Near Eastern religious thought and practice, but it was never my desire for sacrifices at all. And then we get to Jesus, and all of a sudden, we are the temple. Made up of living stones. I think the last Our Daily Dread entry that I presented here was talking about that. It was based upon that from 1 Peter or something. So it's evolved beyond the need for sacrifice to a time in Jesus' own day where there was no more need for a temple and literal animal sacrifices and priests to offer them and all of that. Well, what if what we're seeing in the Bible is a glimpse of movement on the part of God's people from a lower to a higher form of religious consciousness and practice? But what if it was never intended to just be bookended by Genesis and Revelation? What if it was intended to continue on? And if it is, what could that mean for us today? Does that mean that we no longer need physical churches? Does this mean that we no longer need there to be a God whose entire role is to threaten us into mercy and force our hand to clothe the naked and feed the hungry? If we're at a place where we don't need that anymore, then perhaps we have outgrown the God who told us all of these things. So just a little thought for us to think about. If you get a chance to watch this, if you're not able to watch it live, and if you got thoughts on it, don't hesitate to leave a comment. And tomorrow's going to be a pretty busy day for me, but I'll do my best to answer the comments that come in. But I'd be curious to hear what you all think of this, because I think it's definitely interesting, provocative, and challenging and worth thinking about. So that's all, folks. Bye, Timmy. See ya.
All right, it's time for a new segment here on the Misfit Faith podcast called Jason Makes a Wish.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you.
When I was a kid, my dream was to be a professional baseball player and play for the California Angels, as they were then known. My dad used to be a sports writer for the Orange County Register and covered the Angels for years. And so it was kind of in my blood. You know, every spring we'd head out to Palm Springs to go to the Gene Autry Hotel for spring training. And, you know, my mom and I would sit in the stands behind home plate and my dad would be up in the press box. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I just wanted to be a professional ball player. Now, once I got old enough to where that dream required, like, effort, I gave it up. You know, by the time I got to high school and organized sports, you know, involved staying at school till, like, it was dark, I was kind of over it. And I just did my own thing, like surfing and skateboarding and that kind of thing. Well, the dream is alive again, albeit for very different reasons. You see, now I would love to be a pro ball player for the following reasons. First, okay, you know how when the home team's up to bat and each player gets to pick whatever song plays over the sound system when he steps up to the plate? You know, most guys pick some cool hip-hop song. Sometimes it's like a hip-hop song in Spanish, you know, if the player's from that part of the world. I would pick the theme song from The Love Boat. You know, something that just makes absolutely no sense and just confuses anyone. It would be the best. It would be like, now batting for the Angels, number 15, shortstop, Jason Stillman. And then it'd be like, love, exciting and new. Come aboard, we're expecting you. That or maybe Total Eclipse of the Heart. It would be absolutely brilliant. But secondly, I would want to be a pitcher. And here's why. I was never a pitcher when I played. I played Little League all the way up till my early teens. And I was a shortstop. I wasn't a pitcher. I had a strong arm, but not a very accurate one. So pitching wasn't really in the cards for me. In fact, no lie, when my dad managed one of my early Little League teams, I was probably 9, 10 years old. It was kid pitch, though, and it was a preseason game, and he didn't want to show off his real pitching talent. And so he put me on the mound because I could throw hard, but I had no control. And so he put me on the mound, and, you know, I walked everybody and hit some people, and we lost the game. And I was just devastated, but in his mind, it was like, it was strategic, you know? Like, I don't want them to see the real talent we have, you know, on the hill. We got to lull these other teams into a false sense of security. Anyway, if I were to be a professional ball player, I would want to be a pitcher. And here's why. I'd be on the mound. It's only work at an away game, right? So if our team's on the road and we're at an away game, and I would choose, like, the slowest and worst hitter on the other team, and then I'd intentionally walk him for just no reason. And then I'd spend like 20 minutes throwing over to first, you know, even though he's like no threat to steal. Like, he's never stolen a base before ever because he's like 300 pounds, like one of those big fat players. He's not going to steal, but I just keep throwing over 20 minutes, throw over. He's not even leading off. And I'm like watching him like a hawk. You know, I'm stepping off the rubber, looking over to first. You know, wasting as much time as possible, you know, until the crowd is just beside themselves in anger and frustration. And then I'd start to intentionally walk the next batter. But like on the third pitch, instead of like pitching outside to the catcher, I just deliberately bean the batter in the back and then I'd charge the plate because I'm pretty sure that's never been done before. God, I would be so hated. But it would be amusing as hell, at least to me. All right, that is our show, everybody. Thank you for listening. Remember, our phone number here is Y Eli Bites. That's 949-354-2483. JasonStillman.com is my website. Patreon.com/JasonStillman is how you support me. Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you next week.